MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
And welcome to another edition of the Spy Talk podcast. Well, lively week in Washington since we last met. We've had the big story in Washington today is the ouster of Pam Bondi, but close behind it or right beside it is the ouster of the Army Chief of Staff. All this follows on the ouster of DHS Secretary Kristi Noem. And the question I pose to you, my fellow podsters, is, are we better off now than we were 48 hours ago?
Well, it's hard to regret the departure of Pam Bondi. I mean, filled with people who are not qualified for their positions and have made a botch of things, I put Bondi at the top of the list because the politicization of the Justice Department is, in many ways, I think, the most long-lasting, consequential negative Trump's presidency, because it's really hard to see how we get back to it. The mass exit of professional prosecutors and professional FBI agents has left both institutions having much more difficulty responding to the threats that we have. But, you know, just to put something right on the table, how's he going to get somebody confirmed for this position? Because the first question from all Democrats are going to be, Pam Bondi told us that she wasn't going to use the Justice Department for political retribution and go after political enemies. And of course, that's exactly what she did under orders from the commander in chief, who just fired her. And you have a few Republicans, Tom Tillis and perhaps Rand Paul and others, who are beginning to buck against Trump. And I can see, without clear answers to and a clear commitment not to misuse the powers of the Justice Department, I don't see how he's going to get somebody confirmed for this job.
Why do you think it matters? Why do you think he cares? He's come to rely on acting heads of departments. It seems to be part of the strategy. It was in the first term. It's even more so, I think, in the second term. I mean,
his attempt to use actings for U.S. attorneys didn't get him very far. It got, federal courts tossing those U.S. attorneys out.
But it's worked in the cabinet. It's worked at the cabinet level and at the top tiers of cabinet levels. And I just wonder why you think it would matter to him.
That's a very good question, but I have another practical question.
I don't know. Aren't there limits on how long an acting
210 days. 210 days.
All right. Well, gets him into
it's
next
a long
year.
Time. Yeah.
My God.
Yeah.
So, meanwhile, there's a war on. And today we've learned that a F-15 or F-16 pilot has been shot down over Iran. We don't know the status of the pilot, but this follows on this quite bizarre, I'm going to call it, speech that Trump gave about Iran, which seemed more like, one of his casual meetings in the Oval Office rather than a speech to the nation. It didn't offer anything new, did it?
No, I got to say, this is one where I was completely wrong, because I didn't think that Trump would give a nationwide TV speech to the country unless he had something real and dramatic to announce. Either he was calling an end to the war from the U.S. side, or he was sending in troops, or he was going to announce a deal, and he did none of that. All we got is this sort of, rehash of word salad he puts out on Truth Social every night, and I don't think that's going to do much to calm the unease of the public about where this is going.
So, Mike, why do you think he gave it? Do you think he had something to say and changed his mind at the last minute? Do you think he just wanted to mark the moment whether he has something to say or not? Why did he do it?
I mean, that's a really good question. I mean, I think that, you know, probably aides were saying, you got to say something. You got to talk to the country. Our polls are slipping. And somehow they think that, okay, you know, Trump, you know, magically has this hold on at least his base that could bring them on. But, you know, I think it's clearly starting to fray. I mean, you know, the thought occurred to me, you know, we've used the analogy before of Suez 1956. I mean, I'm beginning to think of Iran. This could be Trump's Bay of Pigs, a clear military defeat that, you know, forces us to have never-ending covert efforts to topple the Iranian regime, which is what happened after the Bay of Pigs in Cuba.
Speaking of covert efforts to undermine the regime, I want to mention an extraordinary story that I wrote about over at the Spy Talk newsletter about the CIA role in assassinations against Iran. I mean to say against, not in Iran, but a former CIA officer by the name of Kevin Chalker gave an extraordinary interview to David Kirkpatrick at The New Yorker about his approach to Iranian nuclear scientists, telling them, we'd like you to defect and give you a wonderful new life in America. And that's pretty generous. But if you don't, you're going to die. And according to Chalker's account, those who refused, their names were given to the Israelis to take care of. And that's really an extraordinary thing. If you want to get a summary of it, go to the Spy Talk newsletter or go right to the New Yorker and read this extraordinary piece. I want to ask you, Karen, about something else going on in regard to Pam Bondi's finding. There was reporting this week that Antifa, which is not an organization, but they imagine it is, or they just want to make believe that it is for political reasons. Antifa has been put on a list of national intelligence priorities. Tell us a little bit about that bizarre development.
Yeah, so this is a classified list. And what's come up now is that Antifa has been put on it, or, you know, with an attempt to make Antifa look like a domestic terrorist organization. And just for a little bit of background here, there is no domestic terrorist organization list. This is something that Congress has refused to pass for a number of what I would say are very good reasons. And so now the Trump administration is incrementally moving towards making it official that Antifa is a terrorist organization. And they did this first with an executive order that Trump issued. And now you're seeing it come up on this intelligence report on who organizations are. And you can see that what they're trying to do is to look at organizations abroad that are left-leaning, that they could say are somehow on the same wavelength as these organizations, that what they're calling Antifa in the United States, so that perhaps they can invoke the foreign terrorist organization authorities that we have in the United States. And that seems to be one of the themes that's you know, riding through this. And one of the groups, as the writer points out, has six people in it, one of the groups abroad in Greece. So there's not really there, but it's this question of saying we can do and say whatever we want. And we're just trying to build the argument so that it looks like we, you know, check off the boxes, and we have, we can call Antifa a domestic terrorist organization.
Yeah, but if you remember, it was just a month or so ago, we had Congresswoman Scanlon on from Pennsylvania, who had questioned then Attorney General Bondi about precisely this, about the existence of a secret list of left-wing organizations that she had compiled pursuant to Trump's executive order on Antifa and related groups. And, you know, as far as we know, there's been no responses. Bondi, of course, did not shed any light on the existence of this secret list, what it's being used for, who's on it, what they might do. But clearly, they've got a secret list of left-wing groups, protesters, whatever, who they want to prosecute.
Just to underscore, this is at a time when there has been a dismantling of counterterrorism authorities and expertise throughout the government, not just the DOJ and the FBI and the intelligence agencies. We've seen the National Security Division at DOJ decimated. Counterterrorism was their portfolio. Yes, they focused a lot on foreign terrorist organizations, but all the expertise that we have, and now with threats of, is there going to be some kind of Iranian attack scheduled for the United States? Joe Kent is gone, who is the counterterrorism center director. What
is actually
happening? I don't
know how many people are mourning his departure, but go ahead.
But you get what I'm saying. The point is that there's this reduction in sense of looking at our authorities for counterterrorism writ large, and this focus on trying to create a sense of enemies that can be this broadly expansive, vague category so they can go after those who disagree.
Meanwhile, real enemies are at work, lost amid all these other bombastic developments, is the infiltration of the FBI and DOJ criminal justice systems and surveillance systems by, I guess, Chinese. At the same time, funding for the cybersecurity agency has been stalled. This is on top of the DOGE rampage over at DHS, which eliminated, I think, 40% of jobs of our cyber defense warriors. We've got some real security problems going on, and yet they're wasting time chasing after Antifa, and that is not good. So anyway, we have a special guest today. Going back to the war, we have Yossi Melman coming on, who's a longtime, really superior national security reporter in Israel. And he writes occasionally for Spy Talk. We're very happy for that. He is the co-author of Spies Against Armageddon. He co-authored with Dan Raviv, and we're having him on today. And without further ado, let's get to it. Yossi Melman, welcome to Spy Talk. It's great to have you. We've really enjoyed your pieces over the years at Spy Talk. And of course, I follow your work in the Jerusalem Post and elsewhere. I heard you on NPR last week, sounding very good. It seems like ancient times already last week. So much has happened. You just told us before we came on the air that you just experienced a missile attack. Tell us about that.
I want to be modest because we are already used to these missile attacks since February 28th, when Israel opened the war by assassinating Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader. So sometimes these missile attacks and alarms, which are almost all over Israel, no place in Israel is spared, either by attacks from Hezbollah in the north or from Iran with their ballistic long-range missiles, we are used to it and we rush to the shelters. Some people don't have in-house shelter, like I'm lucky to have it, so they have to go to a public shelter not far from their home. We have a warning time between 5 to 10 minutes, which are when the missiles are being launched and detected by U.S. and Israeli satellites and other means of collecting data. And we stayed there. So last night, before the Jewish Passover, just before the dinner at 7 p.m., the Iranians sent, I think it was intentionally on purpose, they knew that people are gathering for the Seder, for the Passover celebration. They launched like 11 missiles within 45 minutes. And we had to stay in the shelter for 45 minutes.
How are Israelis feeling, if you can make any generalization about the war, what's going on?
The Israeli reaction has been repeating itself almost in every war since I would say, the 67 war or the 73 war on the or the 1982 war invasion of Lebanon, the missile attacks by Saddam Hussein in 91, and most recently by Hezbollah, Hamas, and now Iran.
It's not new to you.
Yeah, well, it's not new, and it is repeating itself in the sense that the first reaction or in the first days, there is a celebratory reaction, euphoric reaction in Israel. The Israeli public is usually behind the government and is approving the government decisions to launch wars or sometimes when we are attacked by the enemies. But as time goes by, people are going to change their attitude because this daily routine is awful. The economy stopped, tourism stops, people suffered by rushing to the shelters, sometimes in the middle of the night with kids. And now with the war with Iran prolongs, I think there is a feeling of fatigue and that the missions or the goals that were ascribed to by the government, by the Netanyahu, the government, have not been achieved. So there is a great deal of realization and disillusionment of the promises that were made by the government.
Well, on that score, you recently wrote for Spy Talk a really interesting piece about the finger pointing within Israeli intelligence agencies over this war. And in particular, there was the account in the New York Times last week that David Barnea, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, the chief of Mossad, had persuaded Netanyahu and the Trump administration that regime change was very possible, that there could be a way to initiate the attack and provoke an uprising among the Iranian people. Obviously, that has not happened. Tell us a little bit about this finger pointing, people blaming each other for what seems to have been a pretty big intelligence failure on the part of Israel.
Yes, Michael, I agree with you that it was wrongly estimated by the Mossad. Now, the Mossad was triumphant in the last war in June 25 and got a lot of credit, including for the first time, they released their footages from their action and operations in Iran, which was very, very unusual and rare. There is another point that has to be emphasized, and this is that most of the work over years, the intelligence work over years, is done by the military intelligence, and especially the Israeli equivalent to the U.S. NSA, Unit 8200. They are the major providers of intelligence and information. However, the Mossad all over the world grabs the headlines. So there is already, even from the outset, there is a sort of a feeling of envious relations between the military intelligence and the Mossad. We in the military intelligence do the hard work, and the Mossad grabs the headlines and get them the aura.
I'd say that people don't know anything about Israeli intelligence except Mossad. And you don't see movies made about military intelligence or Unit 8200. It's always the Mossad that gets the credit. And I understand that military intelligence and Unit 8200 be a little bit irritated by that.
Yes, absolutely, Jeff. Now, the military intelligence is the largest intelligence organization in Israel, has most of the resources, certainly the technological tools and gadgets, AI and big data and the bugging phones and cyber warfare and so on. But they work hand in hand together with the Mossad, which is responsible mostly for human intelligence, for recruiting agents, running agents, but it takes time. So, and it takes The Mossad was successful in helping to achieve some of the goals in June 2025 because they had worked very hard to smuggle in equipment inside Iran. The borders of Iran have been infiltrated to recruit agents there. But to build this infrastructure takes time. And that was exhausted and exposed in June. And then came this war. And the Mossad was not prepared to build, because he is not ready to build instant tools and instant operations. It takes time for them to do it. So most of the work, the workhorse was the military intelligence in this war, and certainly the Air Force, which is the executor of the operations once the intelligence is gathered. And the Mossad role in this war was basically to try to create a chain reaction that once the supreme leader is gone, is assassinated, the Mossad believed that people would gather to the streets or there would be a coup d'etat within the regime. Some sort of top generals from the IRGC, and there will be a regime change. Now, it didn't happen.
How did they get it so wrong? They believed the Kurds were going to come in and start a invasion from the West that would spur the rebellion. Tell us how they got it so wrong.
Well, I'll be briefly, because today they claim, and I talked to a lot of people around Barnea's, the chief of Mossad, around Barnea's role. And to his defense, he claimed that he didn't promise neither Netanyahu nor the Trump administration a rose garden. He said that the chain reaction that maybe would trigger a regime change would took place only after the war, not during the war. That's what he says. And secondly, he is very disappointed that the CIA didn't fulfill its part, which was, for example, to arm the Kurds in order to arrange the invasion from Iraqi Kurdistan inside Iran by Iranian Kurds. So the blame game is that while the military intelligence is saying you did nothing and you failed, the Mossad is saying we didn't fail completely because our role was supposed to be later, not at this stage.
And according to your story, the Trump White House told the Israelis before the shooting started that it was not going to back the Kurds. Is that correct?
Well, I heard Trump saying that the CIA is going to arm the Kurds, and I think week two or week three of the war. And then he said, no, we are not going. I believe that what happened was first, the Iranian Kurds didn't want to participate because they were already highly disappointed of their brothers in Syria and Iraq throughout the history. They were promised to have their autonomy, and they rushed to help rush to wars in Iraq and Syria, and eventually they were betrayed by by the U.S. So that's one reason. The second reason, I think that Erdogan pushed Trump not to allow the Iranian Kurds be armed, because he feared that it would also create some sort of a chain reaction in Turkey itself. There is a huge Kurdish minority in Turkey, and as we all know, Trump is praising Erdogan as his best friend together with Netanyahu.
Yeah. But first, I just want to talk about this disconnect between the IDF, military intelligence, and the Mossad, because I had read in a couple places this was actually Netanyahu made a formalized switch, sort of like took it away from Mossad and said, now the IDF, you're in charge of this, you're what we're going to rely on. I just want to know, that would be my first question. And my second question is, a lot of the things I was reading, some from you actually, gave me the sense that there's a sense of not being willing to trust the Americans to do what they are expected to do or originally say they're going to do. And so it wasn't just in whether or not, you know, they would help in with arming the Kurds, the Iranian Kurds or whatever it was. But just I'm curious what the attitude towards trusting the United States to live up to whatever word, whatever decision, whatever policy agenda they say they're going to support is, and if that has changed over the course of this war.
Well, I don't think so, that it has changed. Still, Israel is America's best ally and vice versa. Obviously, the relations are not equal. It's like relations between a horse and his rider. America has the upper hand. Israel is always dancing to the pipes and the music of the United States. When the United States throughout the history saying enough is enough, Israel has no choice but to follow accordingly. So the relations I think the major accusation against Netanyahu is that he was Trump's whisperer, that he persuaded Trump or gave him the confidence that the Israel, together with the United States, can deliver. And this war is proving that both sides were wrong. I tend to believe that Trump doesn't know how to exit this war now. Israel, on the other hand, is suddenly involved in a war of attrition against the Iranians. I myself, I mean, with all modesty, said in day one of the war, why do we need this war for? Don't we remember what the Iranians, how they fought with the Iraqis for 8 years? I mean, therefore, I don't think there was a need to attack Iran in this particular moment. Not to mention that both Trump and Netanyahu boasted 8 months ago in June 2025 that they obliterated Iran's nuclear sites. And Netanyahu said that he secured the future of Israel for generations. So if generations in Netanyahu parlance is 8 months, then that's not eternity. That's not securing the existence of Israel. I think the war was wrong, and we see it now. And the people are fatigued and are very disappointed, and I don't know how it's going to end. There is a possibility people are talking about it, that Trump within 2-3 weeks will say, we won, end the war, unilaterally will withdraw from the war, and we leave Israel alone with the Iranians, who would not forget, and they have a long memory.
We have to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a second with Yossi Melman. Okay, we're back.
Yeah, on that score, I assume, like everybody, like all of us, you watched President Trump's speech Wednesday night, in which he did indicate, you know, 2 to 3 weeks, and then we'll be out. And you know, one thing that occurred to me is the Iranians are showing no indication that they're going to stop fighting. So the U.S. ends its participation in the war, and the Iranians keep firing missiles at Israel, which almost guarantees that the Israelis will continue to be firing missiles at Iran, right?
Yes, absolutely, Michael. If there is no deal which would ensure that the ceasefire or whatever arrangement is being made, Israel would be part of it, and Israel would be left alone, and we will continue being shelled by Iranian missiles, and Israel and the Israeli Air Force will keep attacking Iranian installations. It is very likely that it may happen if there is no deal. If there is no deal, that Israel would be included in it.
Can we talk a little bit about Lebanon? And sort of, I think you had written a piece about the Iron Beam and its possibilities and its lack of possibilities and its problems. And can you talk a little bit about what's happening with Lebanon and the sense of just how protected Israel feels in terms of drones and other weapons?
Hezbollah is the surprising actor of this war, because only a year and a half ago, with the marvel operation, the Biper operation, and the decapitation of the Secretary General Nasrallah and the top leaders and commanders of Hezbollah, the feeling was that Hezbollah was defeated. But it has taken Hezbollah a year and a half, and they were regrouping, and it turns out now that they have enough weapons to shell Israel. Now, they don't have the long-range missiles that they used to have in the previous wars, so they rarely attack with their missiles central Israel, Tel Aviv, and its surroundings. But for them, they have enough short-range missiles and drones to attack Israeli communities, rural communities, and small mm-hmm. small towns along the border. And for them, the Iron Dam is not sufficient, because the time between the launching of the rocket and the time it can be intercepted is a matter of minutes, 1 minute, 2 minutes, and people don't have time to rush to the shelter. So people are like sitting ducks, and they feel that they are completely naked on one end, and Iron Man is not enough to protect them. Although Iron Man and all the other Israeli layers of aerial defense, the Arrow, the David Sling, are very useful and effective against Iran. The fact that relatively very few Israelis have been killed so far, 22 only, and little and lesser damage was caused to property than in June 25, means that these layers of defense are very effective and are working. But in the northern front with Lebanon, it's not sufficient, and there is a big problem. Now, maybe one more sentence. Israel hoped that Israel already developed an iron beam, a laser activation, but it has its limits, and frankly, they didn't manage to down even one drone in this war against Hezbollah.
Wow.
It's still not perfect. I want to swing back to this piece you wrote for Spy Talk for a moment, Yossi. This rivalry between the IDF, military intelligence, Mossad, and so on, the scapegoating that you wrote that Bibi is doing with Mossad, is that going to have any practical effect, or is that just a storm in a teacup?
Well, no, it's not a storm in a teacup, Jeff. But let me go back to what Karen said, that until 2024, since 2002, when Ariel Sharon was prime minister, he nominated, he authorized, delegated authorities to Meir Dagan, who was then was a legendary head of Mossad. And Dagan became, if you wish, the Tsar of the campaign against Iran. He was in charge of everything, diplomatic means, economic sanctions, a covert operation.
Mm-hmm.
And assassinations, sure, covert operations and assassinations. But in 2024, Netanyahu realized that in a major war, all over, you know, all out war, the means that are available, the tools that are available for the Mossad are not sufficient. And therefore, he delegated the power to run the Iran campaign to the army and to the military intelligence. But I'm sure relations will be repaired somehow. But now there is a bad blood between the two organizations, although they continue to cooperate with each other because it's a wartime. So, you know, they are growing up, and they are serious, and they know that they have to work together hand in hand and to complement each other.
Of course, that can complicate things when it gets to who's communicating with the United States intelligence forces and where in the United States. And so do you think they're getting conflicting? We in the United States are getting conflicting signals, or do you think there's some point at which it's a decision of what's going to be shared with the United States? How do you think that works?
Well, they are, joint war rooms manned by the various agencies of the United States, with the Air Force is working together with the Israeli Air Force, and the coordination was excellent. Sometimes it's a collaboration in mid-air. Are you around, guys? So you will send the missile. So it works perfectly well. Then there is a cooperation between the Mossad and the CIA. And then there is a joint command center between the military intelligence and the various arms and branches of the U.S. Army and the Pentagon. So, all of these agencies are working together, hand in hand. Israeli intelligence services on one hand, and the American intelligence services and the Air Force and the military. So that works very well. And you can see that, the tactical results on the ground are great, but how you translate tactical achievements and successes in the battlefield to a strategic outcome. And that is the problem of this war. We don't see that strategically the United States and Israel will achieve their goals, not to mention win the war. The Iranians don't show any sign of capitulation.
So in the midst of this war, Israel is also facing another crisis, and that's the settler violence in the West Bank, which has really ramped up quite a bit. It's obviously costing Israel, which has already been on the international stage, been cast as a pariah because of Gaza. This is making things even worse. Is there any, give us your sense, whether this government with the fanatics like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich in the cabinet is at all committed to doing anything to really crack down on this settler violence against Palestinians on the West Bank?
In one word, Michael, no. And I don't blame only Ben-Gvir and Smotrich and the zealots and the radical settlers to what's going on and what's happening in the West Bank. And basically, they are terrorizing Palestinians day and night. But it is with the approval of the government, or at least turning a blind eye. Netanyahu, for his political or personal interest, he needs them, because without them, he doesn't have a coalition government. And we are facing elections in a matter of six months, maybe less. And Netanyahu appointed his lackeys in the domestic security service, the head of the new chief of the Shin Bet, the domestic security service, is a settler, although he was a general in the military. So they turn a blind eye. The police is already a semi-fascist police, like maybe comparable to in America to ICE, and they do whatever they want. And the settlers feel that they have a tailwind, that they are supported directly, indirectly by the government, and it's going to be worse and worse and worse. And the vision of Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, not of Netanyahu, but he's allowing them to do it, is basically ethnic, at the long run, ethnic cleansing and war crimes, which are already committed. And the government is silenced, and the security services and the police, which is in the hands of Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, they rarely investigate cases. They don't arrest people. I mean, one of the major tools that that the security services, the Shin Bet, had until recently was administrative detention. It's an old British, since the British mandate rule of Palestine and Israel, tool which have been used if you cannot If you have enough, you know that someone is suspect, but you cannot provide with evidence to arrest him and to put him in court. It's an Israeli kind of phenomena.
Warrantless arrest.
Then you arrest him for arrest him for 6 months. You put him in administrative detention. Recently, and that was mostly used against Palestinians, but occasionally against the settlers. Recently, the government lifted the regulations that Jews, settlers, can, it's a racist notion, that Jews will be put on, into administrative detention. So even this minimal tool, which was pretty effective, at least to deter the settlers of committing their crimes, has been taken away because the government doesn't want to investigate.
Let me ask one follow-up on this. You mentioned that there's likely to be elections in 6 months, perhaps. Now, a lot of American supporters of Israel are really hoping Netanyahu gets defeated in these upcoming elections. He's become such a controversial figure in the United States. But if his prime opponent, Bennett, were to win, would there be a change in policy towards this the West Bank settler violence under a new Israeli government under Bennett?
It will be more subtle. The style will change because Bennett himself is as right winger as Smotrich. They grew in the same hotbed. They were cultivated in the same landscape. Although they believe in Greater Israel. They are religious, but their modes of operations are different. And therefore, if Bennett is going to be the next prime minister, he will be more articulate. He will try to rein the settlers, the violent settlers. It would not solve the Palestinian problem. I don't think that there is any chance for a two-state solution. The two-state solution is gone.
Well, and yet the Gaza war only ended with a deal that included a pathway to citizenship, to statehood for the Palestinians. So there's a fundamental contradiction. You got out of Gaza by signing on to a deal that pledges a two-state solution, but you say a two-state solution is dead.
Not good.
Well, first of all, Gaza has been partitioned. Half of Gaza is controlled by Israel, by the IDF.
Right.
And it will, I don't see them withdrawing, despite the Trump plan and the and his talks about the second stage and the third stage of the Gaza deal. I don't think it's going to happen. So Gaza is being partitioned. If in this 345 square kilometers of the enclave, the Gaza enclave, 2.2 Palestinians live, now their area is half of it. So Gaza and the war in Gaza hasn't ended.
Does Netanyahu go to jail if he loses the election?
If he loses the election, he will go to jail. But many Israelis doubt whether we will have elections at all, because Netanyahu will use every mean available to him, every tool available to him, in order to obstruct the elections.
That sounds familiar to us.
Well, you know, yeah, maybe we will have January 6th repeated in Israel. So I'm not sure elections will be held. But even if Bennett is emerging victorious, it will be very difficult for him to form a government, a coalition government, because the opposition is so fragmented and so divided. And most of them, anyway, Bennett and Lieberman and others are part of the Israeli right. They are not liberal. They are not the progressive, but their style is different. So there will be a change. I think the atmosphere will be less poisonous, because the atmosphere in Israel is very poisonous.
Less poisonous.
Well, I think you've probably succeeded in depressing most of our listeners, Yossi, more than they're used to on this podcast.
this is the reality which I witness every day. I mean, you know, I have to be honest to myself and to the fact.
Yeah. Well, with that happy note, Yossi, we'll look forward to your next pieces for Spy Talk and elsewhere. Thank you for dodging the missiles and coming on our show today.
Yeah.
Stay safe.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeff, Michael, and Karen.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk, and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai, and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to SpyTalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Hi, I'm Moji Alawodeyal from the Feminist Buzzkills Live Pod, the only podcast that helps you navigate the news in this post-pro anti-abortion hellscape. Each week, with co-host Liz Winstead, we dissect all the news from that sketchy intersection of abortion and misogyny with providers and activists working on the ground. The cherry on top is we have amazing comedy guests who help us laugh through the rage. Feminist Buzzkills Live drops Fridays wherever you pod. Listen and subscribe, because when BS is popping, we pop off.